last case of the day, Doe versus U.S. Department of Homeland Security, number 25-1628. Mr. Kurtz.
First for appellants, may it please the court. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
I want to focus on 3 points this morning. First, appellees lack Article III standing because their alleged injuries flow from their New Jersey criminal proceedings and from inter-sovereign custody logistics, not from the denial of any right that ICE is legally required to provide. Second, the Sixth Amendment protects criminal defendants' trial rights, but the access to courts doctrine does not apply when a prisoner seeks to defend himself against criminal charges. And third, appellees lack a valid access to courts claim because they have not identified a meritorious underlying claim that ICE caused them to lose. Starting with Article III standing, the Supreme Court's cases established that Article III requires a concrete injury in fact, fairly traceable to the defendant, not one produced by the independent decisions of other actors. Here, there are two Article III problems. First, the injury in fact problem, the lack of a legally protected interest. This court's decision in Bowman provides the priority of prosecution is a matter of comity between sovereigns, and that a prisoner lacks a protected interest in having his case proceed in one sovereign's court rather than another's.
But that's when there's a change in the jurisdiction, and primary jurisdiction can go to exhaustion. But there's not a challenge here to the nature of the challenge is not the jurisdiction be transferred to the state. It's within the bounds of the federal facility to be able to engage in remote proceedings. So how did the comedy line of cases even come into play?
Well, Your Honor, here we have a class of prisoners asserting that the federal custodian enabled them to virtually access their state proceedings. And while the state may have an interest in having the New Jersey proceedings go forward rather than the federal proceeding, the detainees themselves do not have a protected interest in having their case proceed virtually or by any other means in New Jersey. And regardless of whether their objective is to be transferred to that court, they're still asserting that they want their case to proceed in that jurisdiction rather than in the federal jurisdiction. And Bowman establishes that they lack a legally protected interest in...
Rather than. They're not saying rather than. They're not asking the federal government to stop prosecuting their immigration matters. They're just saying, please permit a dual sovereign to prosecute us at the same time. Does that make sense?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't make a difference. ICE, the federal government has lawful custody over them. It has priority of prosecution. It's under no obligation to enable them to move forward in New Jersey and continue that their proceeding in that court as long as ICE maintains priority and lawfully maintains them in its custody.
So it's under no obligation to do that, even if failure to do so would deprive the detainees of constitutional rights, as they allege.
Other doctrines protect their constitutional rights. The Sixth Amendment protects their trial rights. That gets to the traceability problem. But as far as protected interest, you know, it's clear under this court's decision in Bowman that the beneficiary of the rule is the sovereign of the comity rule is the sovereignties, and that the prisoner lacks a protected interest in having his case proceed in New Jersey court, rather than federal court.
But if these...
It was my understanding that comedy applies... Really, when you're dealing with immigration case, it's not a criminal case. So I don't see how comedy comes in at all.
Judge Roth, it was a little difficult to hear you. Could you guys lean into the microphone a little more?
Just repeat it. Yeah, you're good. Can you ask the question again?
Oh, sorry. My understanding of comedy is when it's when you're dealing with two criminal cases, and here the immigration proceeding is not a criminal case. And so I just don't understand how comedy is an issue at all.
Your Honor, comedy is an issue because here we have an immigration proceeding, which is another type of case that gives a sovereignty, in this case, the federal government, the right to take custody. Yes, but the fact that it normally applies, or that it in most cases it's been applied in a situation where there are two criminal cases is not relevant. The fact that it's an immigration case or an immigration case also gives the federal government the right to take custody over detainees. And the point is that they're lawfully in ICE's custody and they want to have their case proceed in New Jersey and for ICE to enable them to appear in that case. And they lack a protected interest in having that case move forward while they're in the federal government's custody. The other problem is traceability. Plaintiffs assert that their unresolved criminal charges produce certain harms, but the fact that their charges are unresolved depends on the choices of New Jersey prosecutors and courts. If a defendant's presence is required at a particular proceeding and it can't be obtained via virtual means, then the prosecutor can seek a writ of habeas corpus ad pro sequendum, which, by the way, ICE has said that it will honor. And if prosecutors decline to do so, then the court should impose whatever consequences are appropriate, you know, right to presence, right to speedy trial, right to confrontation problems may arise. And the state court can address those problems as they, you know, as appropriate.
Can we step back to the injury and the Bowman, the line of cases dealing with comedy? Because, you know, building off of Judge Freeman's question, it seems that those cases deal with situations where it's a question of jurisdiction and where the relinquishment of the detainee would halt the proceedings. We've said, and the courts recognize, that there's not a right of a detainee to say, I'd prefer to proceed with that prosecution. But here we have a situation where, whether they like it or not, the detainees have two sovereigns that are proceeding in parallel, contemporaneously, with actions against them. When that happens, especially with a criminal case, there are, of course, all sorts of rights at issue, appointment of counsel, obtaining evidence, you know, memories of witnesses, and the like. So where that is happening, regardless of the desires of the detainee, why is the comedy line of cases even relevant?
Well, Your Honor points out a problem. It may well be a problem that the two prosecutions are moving forward at the same time. You know, I don't want to accuse New Jersey of violating the criminal defendants' rights, but they may be by proceeding with that prosecution while they're unable to be present for the proceeding, and while they're unable to confront witnesses against them. So Sixth Amendment and due process problems may arise.
But they're only unable to because of the policy that we're talking about today. And that's where it seems that these are intertwined in a way that's different than the transfer of jurisdiction in the typical, you know, dual sovereign criminal case.
Your Honor, they're unable to because ICE has priority of prosecution over them, and ICE lacks sufficient resources to facilitate state criminal proceedings, given its duty, its obligation to facilitate immigration proceedings and meetings between immigration attorneys and their clients. That's ICE's primary obligation. it doesn't have the resources to facilitate immigration proceedings, meetings between immigration attorneys and their clients, and at the same time facilitate New Jersey criminal prosecutions and perhaps other state prosecutions. That's not ICE's duty. If ICE chose to do that, and ICE has said we will honor writs of habeas ad pro sequendum, we just don't have the resources to facilitate virtual appearances.
But hasn't it been doing that, exactly that, for over a year now?
Because the district court ordered it to do so, but it's had to draw resources from other areas. That, I mean, ICE is capable of drawing resources from other areas if it needs to, but it's not meeting its you know, its congressional, the obligations that the Congress set forth for it, and it's entitled to set its own priorities, and its priority in this case is not to facilitate state criminal prosecutions.
Did the government seek a stay?
A stay of what, Your Honor?
Of the district court's ruling?
No, Your Honor, we have not, we did not seek a stay of the district court's ruling. So I was talking about the traceability problem, just to finish up there. So the court can impose, the state courts can impose whatever consequences are appropriate for any Sixth Amendment or due process problems that might arise because the criminal defendants are unable to appear on their own behalf. That is the source of the asserted injuries that stem from Appellees' unresolved criminal charges. And that creates a traceability problem under Article 3.
And their claims are not only about Sixth Amendment deprivations, though, it's also First and Fifth. So access to courts as a First Amendment right. And so New Jersey wouldn't be able to remedy that in the same way. So why don't you address that? What?
Yes, Your Honor. So the access to courts doctrine simply doesn't apply in the context of criminal defense. And that's because the Fifth Amendment, the Due Process Clause, and the Sixth Amendment and criminal procedure rules protect criminal defendants' trial rights. Those are the sources of rights in this area. The court's been very clear that the access to courts doctrine, which arises primarily under the First Amendment, does not apply in this area. The court said in Rivera, quote, only certain types of claims, specifically direct or collateral attacks on a prisoner's conviction or sentence, or civil rights suits challenging the conditions of his confinement, can support an access to courts injury. End quote. And the court said a very, very similar thing in Monroe, and the courts rejected other types of underlying claims.
But they did that outside of the context of pretrial of pretrial detainees, right? They never said there in a case addressing pretrial detainees, you shall not have this access to court right.
The Rivera case did not involve pretrial detainees, but I don't know that there's been no case involving pretrial detainees in which a court has said such a thing. The line of cases has been very consistent. This court said in Watson, it affirmed dismissal because the underlying claim was the plaintiff sought to press charges against correction officials, and the court said that he had no actual injury because the underlying claim was not, quote, one of the two types of cases enumerated in Lewis. Both the Supreme Court and this court have been very consistent. Only collateral attacks on conviction or sentence or civil rights conditions of confinement claims. And that's because we have other sources of rights in this area, the Fifth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment.
But isn't the extension, the logical extension of your argument, that the government could be prosecuting someone criminally in federal court, hold them at a federal detention center, and that detention center could say, I'm not letting you go to court, and the prisoner would have no recourse against the detention center because he's a pretrial detainee?
Well, Your Honor, if the government did that, then it would have a due process problem in federal criminal court.
But I'm asking about a civil recourse. Would the prisoner, are you saying that prisoner would not be able to sue the prison to say you're depriving me of access to courts because he's a pretrial detainee?
Possibly there would be no civil remedy, that's right, but there would be a, you know, at least under the access to courts doctrine. But that's not the situation here. Here we have a comity problem. It's two different sovereigns. It's one thing to apply the access to courts doctrine when the detaining sovereign is the same as the prosecuting sovereign. But here we have a different detaining sovereign and prosecuting sovereign. And it's clear that Sixth Amendment and Fifth Amendment rights run against the prosecuting sovereign, not another sovereign that happens to be detaining the defendant. So,
what if these folks had civil cases that they were prosecuting in a state court somewhere? Would their access to court rights be pursuable in that context?
Certainly not, Your Honor. The court's been extremely clear on that. In Ross, this court affirmed dismissal because the underlying claim was a medical malpractice claim. It wasn't one of the two types of claims enumerated in Lewis. In Watson, the court did the same. You know, the prisoner wanted to press criminal charges. There wasn't a civil thing. He wanted to press criminal charges. But there have been many cases where the underlying claim was some other type of civil claim that the prisoner wanted to litigate. And the courts have said that doesn't fall under the access to courts doctrine. It's only two types of underlying claims are permissible, and this type of claim is not one of them.
If they were pursuing, if they're pursuing post-conviction challenges to convictions that have been final, do these detainees have the right to access to courts?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor, they do. Yes. The other access to courts problem here is that they haven't identified an underlying claim. The Supreme Court said in Lewis that an access to courts claimant must show an actual injury. And the court said in Harbury that in order to show actual injury, the plaintiff must point to, or must show that official action hindered the pursuit of a, quote, non-frivolous or arguable underlying claim. Here, appellees have made no attempt to identify such a claim. And they say they can't do so because they're criminal defendants and that this equates to a burden-shifting rule for criminal defendants. But we're not saying that New Jersey can shut criminal defendants out of court if they don't prove an affirmative defense. What we're saying is that appellees chose to bring a civil access to courts claim against ICE. That claim has elements, and one of them is to identify a non-frivolous or meritorious underlying claim. They haven't done so.
But that was a mechanism to ensure that if there was going to be an affirmative claim raised by a detainee, that it have a basis. It's akin to standing, that there be some reason that employee would be able to invoke the access right. But where you're talking about defense of a criminal prosecution, that's not the injury in not being able to defend oneself would seem apparent on the face of it, rather than requiring the showing of a meritorious defense.
Well, Your Honor, the fact that the requirement to identify a non-frivolous underlying claim doesn't seem to make sense in this context just goes to show that appellees have brought an access to courts claim in a context in which it doesn't apply.
Some other circuits, like the Second Circuit in Britain, have talked specifically about the right of access to the courts to defend against criminal charges. Do you think that line of cases, the circuits that have taken that position, simply don't have a basis?
I think that the Fifth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment are the appropriate source of rights, of constitutional rights in this area, not the access to courts doctrine. It's also important to note that this case comes to the court on a preliminary injunction where appellees were required to show a likelihood of success under existing law. They are not able to do so where they're asking the court to extend the access to courts doctrine into a new area. No Supreme Court or Third Circuit case has ever held that the access to courts right extends to criminal defense. This court has held a very firm line, as has the Supreme Court, that there are only two types of underlying claims that are sufficient, and the plaintiff must show an actual injury. Here, they haven't met either of those requirements. This is a particularly, given the preliminary injunction context, it's a particularly inapt case in which to extend the doctrine into new territory, into a new category.
I'm not sure I follow, and we're not talking about qualified immunity. Are you saying that the first prong, that the likelihood of success requires showing that the law was already clearly established?
No, Your Honor, I'm not invoking that doctrine. No, what I'm saying is that under the preliminary injunction standard, they were required to show a likelihood of success under existing law, rather than the existing law component, not the likelihood of success is what I'm talking about. That here they're asking to extend the doctrine to a new category.
But if a court were to determine that that extension were warranted under the law, that would satisfy the likelihood of success on the basis of existing law, right?
The law would not have been existing at the time, Your Honor, no. The existing law is a body of case law from the Supreme Court and from this court that exists at the time that the case is litigated, not a new decision after the fact from this court.
You're in essence arguing that the district court, having extended a right of access beyond existing law, is itself a basis for reversal?
Yes, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that the court, the ruling fell outside or exceeded the preliminary injunction standard in extending the case to this new category, given that no Third Circuit or Supreme Court case had ever recognized an access to courts claim in this criminal defense area. And the other point here is that the access to courts injury is the inability to pursue a non-frivolous claim. Missed appearances may matter under other doctrines, like the Sixth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment. And they say as well that the inability to resolve their criminal charges poses problems for them in immigration court, and that may entitle them to litigate a due process claim within the context of immigration proceedings. And you know, if necessary, then to bring that case to this court on petition for review. The remedies for plaintiffs are in immigration court by asserting a due process claim. If their inability to proceed in New Jersey creates a problem in immigration court, they can bring that to this court on petition for review. If their inability to proceed in New Jersey violates their due process or Sixth Amendment rights, they can obtain a remedy for that in state court. The problem is that they're choosing to bring the claim as a civil access to courts claim in federal district court, and that is not the appropriate vehicle to litigate this type of claim.
Do you acknowledge that the purpose of the meritorious underlying claim requirement is to assess injury, whether the plaintiff would be injured by the lack of access to courts?
Yes, Your Honor. And the court's decision in Bowman said, well, it's yes, the part of the injury in fact inquiry is whether the prisoner or the plaintiff possesses a protected interest.
Okay. Well, I guess what I'm getting at, so I think we've said, and the Supreme Court has said, just the meritorious underlying claim, because you know, if you have a frivolous claim, you're not being injured by your inability to pursue that frivolous claim, right? And so, and that shows us that you're being injured, right?
Yes.
Okay. And so, these detainees are arguing that they are being injured by their inability to attend the criminal court proceedings, right? And so aren't those two sides of one coin? They're just different methods of showing the injury necessary to proceed on an access of courts claim.
Your Honor, whatever they may say about those injuries, as a doctrinal matter, they can have no injury because they lack a protected interest in having their case proceed in New Jersey while they are in lawfully in federal custody.
But that's not actually the question. The Bill of Rights provides them with a number of rights that attend their criminal prosecutions in New Jersey. And whether they have a right to go forward or not, like they're alleging that those constitutional rights are being infringed upon, and they're saying that is an injury. Is that how you understand their argument too?
Yes, Your Honor, that's okay. How I understand.
So that's the injury, and my understanding of their argument is they're saying that suffices. I don't need an underlying. A meritorious underlying claim. I have a meritorious constitutional right that I'm invoking. That is enough. So,
well, the requirement to identify an underlying claim is not an Article III issue or that doesn't really go to the Article III inquiry. That's a requirement for this cause of action to proceed under a access to courts cause of action. Constitutional cause of action, they need to show that they have a meritorious underlying claim, and they haven't done so here, and it doesn't, you know, and the fact that it doesn't fall into one of the recognized categories for this type of claim is another cause of action problem. On the Article III problem, it's that they lack a protected interest, and that there's the traceability problem because the New Jersey courts and prosecutors are the source of these asserted injuries, not the federal government that happens to be detaining them.
How would you describe the right of access? You're distinguishing it from the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment, but the case law seems to identify those as the constituent interests that create a right of access.
Your Honor,
how would you describe the right of access?
Yes, Your Honor. The right of access is the right to access a court for the purpose of litigating a collateral attack on a conviction or sentence or a civil rights conditions of confinement claim.
To vindicate what rights?
Primarily, if it's a First Amendment, It's not entirely clear, but the doctrine seems to be rooted primarily in the First Amendment. The Supreme Court has also invoked the Fifth Amendment, but the First Amendment is the source of this right that they've invoked most frequently.
Judge Roth?
I have no questions, thank you.
Let me ask one other, which is, say we did recognize a right of access, that would not be the end of the inquiry, where we're dealing with the resources of the federal government at a detention center. Where we're talking about rights that are infringed for convicted detainees, we look to the Turner standard. What is your position as to the balancing of the government's interest in resources and how that would be articulated with a pretrial detainee?
Your Honor, because ICE has priority, it does not have an obligation to allocate resources to this area, to facilitating a state criminal prosecution. And the government is entitled to set its own priorities and according to congressional mandate. And, Congress is not mandated that ICE facilitate state criminal prosecutions for its detainees. So our position would be that balancing is not appropriate in this area.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear from you in rebuttal. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Shira Wasatsky from Legal Services of New Jersey, appearing on behalf of plaintiffs at appellees. May it please the court. So, Your Honors, before the preliminary injunction was issued in this case, the people that ICE detained at Moshannon could use virtual means to attend immigration court proceedings and state court family court proceedings, but were prohibited from using the very same technology to attend state criminal court. That was ICE's policy, even though there's an affirmative right to access courts, even though the government relies on the existence of the unresolved criminal charges to justify the initial and the continued detention of the people that they hold in custody. And that was their policy, even though the government's in-person writ policy does not meaningfully work. The district court was
to this point, we have functioned in the physical world. And where there is an interruption of the jurisdiction of one sovereign, or drain on resources that might go along with relinquishing a detainee, we said that the sovereign that has primary jurisdiction is to exhaust. And that's what the Supreme Court has told us as well. Just because we've moved from the physical world into a virtual one, why should that those same interests and the respect for a respective sovereign not come into play?
Your Honor, because the reasons for those interests don't apply here. There was a concern about, as Judge Freeman noted, to displace one sovereign at the expense of the other, or to say one proceeding should happen before the other proceeding. That is not what plaintiffs are seeking here. Judge Krause, there's no, as you noted before with my friend on the other side, there's no challenge here in terms of changing jurisdiction, where someone's custody is actually physically relinquished and the person is moved from one detaining sovereign to the other detaining sovereign. And as Judge Roth also noted in her question, this is not the two criminal cases that were fully separate that the comedy line of cases acknowledge.
But there is a drain on resources and an interruption of whatever proceedings might otherwise be going on within the detention center.
Your Honor, respectfully, I disagree. That's not part of the record here. And I would respectfully note that my friend on the other side, in this preliminary injunction appeal, where they could have raised any of the four standards, any of the four elements for the district court is required to balance, did not challenge the balance of interest here. Indeed, this injunction has been in place since January of 2025 for about, I think it's about 18 months now. And as Your Honor noted, the government did not seek to stay that ruling. Indeed, the government sought to clarify the ruling and did not argue that there were insufficient resources at that point. And in the 18 months since, the government has never gone back to the district court and said to the district court, we cannot do this. We don't have the resources to do this.
But the record is replete with affidavits from the director that it is a drain on resources, laying out the near capacity, the limited number of rooms, the need for staff to accompany someone into a private room and to monitor. So why isn't it the case with the primary directive of the center to pursue the immigration proceedings, that they can prioritize that just as if we were in the physical world and they were proceeding with their own prosecution?
So, Your Honor, two answers to that question. First is these are not just that ICE is proceeding with removal proceedings. The difference here between having two different criminal in addition to having two different criminal independent proceedings, the two proceedings here are indeed intertwined. ICE is not, it's not just that ICE is bringing removal proceedings against people in their custody. It's also that ICE is relying on the very fact of unresolved criminal charges to both begin the initial detention and then to continue the detention of the people in their custody. As the trial court noted, During the hearing on the preliminary injunction, there were several named plaintiffs who, after the case was brought, were provided with access, virtual access to the courts, and were then released from immigration custody, because at that point, either the immigration court or the agency itself exercised its own jurisdiction to, or I'm sorry, Your Honor, exercised its own discretion to release that person because there were no longer criminal charges.
But that seems a precarious line of argument for you to follow, because as soon as you're talking about the consequences for the immigration detention, aren't we in an area of benign, and we're channeling all claims there, we wouldn't have jurisdiction?
No, Your Honor. First, I would respectfully note that the government only challenged B9 with respect to count two, so the court need not reach that issue because the district court did not rely on count two to issue the preliminary injunction in this matter. But more than that, it's a different situs of harm here.
Just to test that a little bit, I mean, if we're talking about federal jurisdiction and that's been stripped by a statutory provision, don't we need to consider whether it comes into play?
So, Your Honor, if this court believes that B9 is independently applicable with respect to count one, which the district court relied on, yes, I don't disagree. I'm simply pointing out that the government only challenged it with respect to count two, which was not what the district court relied on in issuing its decision. However, the claims here arise from access restrictions at the detention facility at Moshannon and not from a challenge to any immigration adjudication. There's no one here that's challenging a removal order or the initial detention decision or a bond determination. The constitutional harms that are accruing here cannot really be raised or remedied within removal proceedings, and the injury is occurring at the point of restricted access. Because people can't resolve their criminal matters, people are having downstream impact on the fact of their detention and what ICE is doing, but the injury itself is that they cannot resolve those criminal matters.
Well, so on the one hand, if it's having an effect on the criminal proceeding, it's interfering with their right to defend the New Jersey proceeding, isn't then the onus on New Jersey not to proceed with the criminal prosecution and to hold that until the detainee is released? To the extent the argument is that it would have consequences for the immigration detention, that would seem to get us into the area of jurisdiction stripping.
So, Your Honor, here we're asserting that there are two different harms. The first harm is the right of court access itself, where the inability to access court is a harm because people have the right to challenge the criminal cases that are brought against them by the state. We're not saying New Jersey doesn't have obligations here. What we're saying is that New Jersey's obligations and ICE's obligations are not mutually exclusive. New Jersey might be the one to conduct the criminal proceeding, but ICE is exercising exclusive physical control over that person. And in fact, the district court found, and there's nothing in the record that would make it an abuse of discretion, that New Jersey fully relinquished physical custody over those individuals. And indeed, there is nothing in the record that shows that ICE or any of the defendants, anyone in the government, then notified New Jersey, hey, this is a person that we're bringing into custody. This is where we are moving them to. There's no evidence that New Jersey has knowledge of where that person is held or how to continue those rights. As far as New Jersey knows, a state court judge ordered that person released from New Jersey custody. And so the injury here flows from ICE's policy that's preventing participation and not from New Jersey's prosecution of the case. And Your Honor, with respect to the Sixth Amendment,
why wouldn't that participation simply be postponed if New Jersey were to stay its hand?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not sure.
The participation in the criminal proceeding and the defense of the criminal proceeding, why wouldn't that just be postponed if things proceeded as they would in the normal course of two sovereigns with a criminal prosecution? That is, if New Jersey stayed its hand. and postponed any further proceedings unless and until that detainee is released.
So first, Your Honor, criminal proceedings cannot be postponed forever. People still have speedy trial rights. People still have other rights that must be effectuated. And I do want to note that there are two different ways that people can assert their Sixth Amendment rights. My colleague frequently discusses the cases in which someone challenged their Sixth Amendment with respect to the prosecuting sovereign. But this court has previously found that a detaining facility also has obligations under the Sixth Amendment. Now, our argument is not that ICE independently owes Sixth Amendment duties, but that ICE may not prevent the exercise of rights under the Sixth Amendment while exercising full physical control over that individual. In Cobb v. Atik, this court found that detaining entities do have obligations under the Sixth Amendment, at least with respect both to speedy trial and access to counsel, where Philadelphia prison authorities were transferring people from across the state, making it such that plaintiffs could not meet with their attorneys or prepare cases, and that they missed criminal court hearings, just like the named plaintiffs and members of the putative class in this case. And this court affirmed the injunction in that matter. Just want to respectfully note, I am aware in the briefing that the government makes many arguments with respect to the fact that in Cobb, you might have had the same prosecuting and detaining sovereign. I'd like to respectfully note that in looking at the facts of those cases, at least several members of the class were being held there at the request of the United States Marshal's Office. And so at least some members of that class, we may presume, were actually had different detaining, had a different sovereign responsible for the prosecution and a different sovereign that's responsible for the detention. And so in addition to the Sixth Amendment constitutional claims that should permit an access to court, plaintiffs also bring claims under the First and the Fifth Amendment as well. And Your Honors, I do want to quickly address the application of court access in the criminal defense context. Judge Freeman, you helpfully noted, Your Honor, and acknowledged a difference between prisoners and a pretrial context, which is something that's also important when talking both about what the claims look like and whether an underlying claim needs to be, or an underlying defense needs to be fully articulated. It is logically incoherent that people would have the right to attack a conviction after trial, but no right to appear at that trial in the first instance. And in fact, the Third Circuit has previously found that narrowing access to court's claim, challenging convictions and conditions of confinement, is not applicable if the person has not been convicted. And I'm looking at Prater v. City of Philadelphia. The circuit recognized that Lewis v. Casey, when the United States Supreme Court in that case was discussing the types of claims available, it was discussing the consequences of convictions. Where here we're in the pretrial context. Indeed, I believe that all of the cases that were cited by the government here involve prisoners only, and use the word prisoner, looking at Monroe v. Beard or other cases decided by this court. Indeed, I am not aware of any court that has ever found that people with a conviction have greater rights than people without one in the pretrial detention context. With respect to the injury, I respectfully disagree with my friend on the other side who was trying to differentiate the injury requirement as a cause of action in the court access context from Article 3, because that is not what the United States Supreme Court said. To make out a claim, plaintiffs need to show that the proceeding involved both access to the courts, which is not disputed here, and an actual injury. That's from Hudson v. Robinson. And that actual injury requirement, Your Honors, comes from the standing doctrine. If you look at the United States Supreme Court case in Lewis, which was explicating bounds, what that case was doing was outlining how access to a law library was not a freestanding requirement. A plaintiff has to show how the lack of access actually impacted that person's ability to pursue a case, and in those cases, civil litigation. That's not the same context here as a criminal defendant, where absence is injury itself, as found by the Ninth Circuit in Jonas v. Blanis.
Could you, I want to ask you the same question, how we should conceptualize the right of access. Is this semantics? What is what we're really talking about? Simply the Fifth and Sixth Amendment, maybe some aspects of the First Amendment. You know, right of access is not one of the enumerated rights in the Bill of Rights. So what are we really talking about here?
Your Honor, courts have previously found the right of access grounded in both the First, the Fifth, and the Sixth Amendment. The First and Fifth have been taken together, both looking at the right to petition, and I would note that, for example, Josephina and Isabella Doe, two named plaintiffs, for instance, survivors of domestic violence, who were arrested during an incident of domestic violence, explained the reason they wanted to access the court was to petition the court, to tell their story and explain their experience. You also have the Fifth Amendment, where you have the right to due process. And so you have the First and the Fifth Amendment that lays the groundwork in claims like, in cases like Bounds and Lewis and in Christopher v. Harbury. Indeed, in the United States Supreme Court, in Christopher v. Harbury, identified two kind of ways to look at court access claims. The Supreme Court looked at backwards-looking claims, like a Bounds claim involving the law library, and they looked at forward-looking claims, looking at the denial of access, where what a plaintiff is seeking is to be in a position to pursue a claim for relief once a frustrating condition is removed. And the U.S. Supreme Court in footnote 8 included several examples of where that court, that First and Fifth Amendment court access right played in. That was the court waiving a filing fee for a habeas, waiving fees for direct appeals in criminal and petty crime cases, waiving a transcript fee for appellate review in a criminal case. And what plaintiffs are seeking here, at least under the First and the Fifth Amendment, is just like what Christopher v. Harbury, the United States Supreme Court, recognized, where plaintiffs are seeking relief from a frustrating condition that a detention facility places a frustrating condition that is placed on the people who are seeking court access. Separately, there's also the Sixth Amendment right, which includes the right to court access, the right to vindicate all those things that are included within the Sixth Amendment.
So why aren't we talking about it in those terms? If you've chosen to package it as a right of access, and does that set a higher hurdle, put in place a hurdle that you might not need to erect, if the argument today is really about the Fifth, the Sixth Amendment, the incorporated by the 14th?
So, Your Honor, what we are asking the court to do today is to find that there was no abuse of discretion when the district court found it likely that plaintiffs would succeed on the merits of their case under both the First, the Fifth, and the Sixth Amendment. Plaintiffs brought as many claims they could to challenge this, what they see as this unconstitutional policy that denies them court access under all three amendments, the First and Fifth usually taken together, and the Sixth Amendment taken separately. And I just want to add, Your Honor, with respect to the Sixth Amendment, turning back to Cobb for a moment, the Third Circuit walked through the history of the rights to counsel and speedy trial causes and traced its long history back to the Magna Carta and the English Bill of Rights and this whole long history of these rights being guaranteed. And in that context, this circuit found that, and I'm quoting, Your Honor, the idea that distance alone may deprive one of the constitutionally protected liberties is well-grounded in the ancient underpinnings of our laws and constitution. Now, we are not asking this court today to resolve this distance question. Plaintiffs have never asked that distance between them and the court be closed or that they are transferred from one jurisdiction to another. Plaintiffs are asking this court today to acknowledge under its precedents that a court does not abuse its discretion when it finds a violation, when the distance directly interferes with constitutional rights, and there is an easily available, already available remedy that can allow them access to the courts.
Well, we've got a record that may suggest it's not so easily available. If we were to assume arguendo that there exists a right of access in this context, there's still the interests of the government, the federal government, and the limited resources of a detention center that would have to be accounted for, right?
Sure. So, Your Honor, first...
And normally, we give great deference to the administration of the prison and their assessment of what resources are needed. We do look in stand with a standard like Turner at what alternatives there are. But here, the federal government has provided an alternative of honoring the writs when they're issued by New Jersey to physically produce the detainee. So if we were to assume arguendo that there's a right of access in this context, why doesn't the test that we would need to apply, accounting for the detention center's interest, ICE's interest, and the resources at play, the alternative available, why doesn't that tilt the other way?
Sure, Your Honor, with the court's permission, if I may try to answer that in three parts. First, with respect to what the Constitution requires, and looking back at those examples the United States Supreme Court cited in Christopher v. Harbury, all of them require some expenditure on the part of the government entity in order to guarantee the right of court access, whether it's waiving a filing fee in a habeas or in an appeal, or more specifically, Your Honor, looking at the right to a law library sufficient that you can bring your own claims attacking a conviction or attacking or bringing, rather, a civil rights lawsuit. That right, it is not a freestanding right to a law library for sure, but there is a requirement that a detaining facility expend those resources and build that type of facility, making it available to everyone, whether they're in solitary confinement, whether they're in general population. That is a requirement that is required under the United States Constitution that the United States Supreme Court has found. And so this is not an affirmative right that comes without any resource expenditure. In addition, though, Your Honor, the district court had the information before it as to the resources that was available to the facility, and the declaration first that was submitted, pretty bare bones declaration first that was submitted by Mr. Kemp, a declaration submitted by Mr. O'Neill, and the district court weighed the evidence before it and found that there were resources there in order to guarantee resources that must be expended, at least in some way, to guarantee the constitutional right of court access. And we don't believe that anything has been put in the record that disturbs the district court's weighing of that evidence or its decision with respect to that. Now,
well, the district court here addressed the constitutional analysis in a relatively summary way. Where is there any indication of the sort of deference that would normally be paid where resources of a prison are at issue?
Your Honor, the district court expressly acknowledged the deference to how resources are spent at the facility. Indeed, in the decision on the motion for clarification, and I believe it was, I'm envisioning it, it was a footnote, I don't remember what page, but the district court noted that in deference to the facility, it was not going to tell the facility, this is how you should schedule things, this is the order in which your facility should operate, or that you need to purchase anything else. What the district court said is that it's the parties who are best positioned in order to effectuate the right to court access, said that the parties should discuss and laid out a series of questions about how that those priorities should be adjusted, and noted its own discretion and deference to the way that a facility should operate. And so the district court acknowledged it, by the way, also at the hearing on the preliminary injunction, and then again in deciding the motion to clarify. And the district court acknowledged its own deference and did not say to the facility, this is how you should operate, but rather, I see what you've submitted as the testimony, as evidence about what your resources are. There is a constitutional right that needs to be adhered to.
Do courts give civil detention authorities the same level of deference that they give to prison authorities as set out in Turner?
Your Honor, I believe that the Turner standard is applicable with convictions. I am not, generally, when somebody is in pretrial detention, as these civil detainees are, there are more rights that are afforded to them. With respect to ordering the facility, I believe that the district court here was as deferential, acknowledging the ability of this civil detention facility to operate while also requiring that they secure the constitutional rights of the people in their custody. So, Your Honors, unless the court has any further questions, the district court here issued a narrow injunction that requires ICE to use its existing resources to provide the people that it detains access to criminal courts, in addition to the access it already provides to immigration courts and state court family courts. In this appeal, the government is not denying the policy, the government is not denying its capacity to comply, and the government has not challenged irreparable harm. The district court did not abuse its discretion, and we respectfully request that the court affirm the preliminary injunction. Thank you.
Thank you.
My friend acknowledged at one point that plaintiffs' asserted injuries are downstream from their New Jersey criminal proceedings, and that's a key point here. The relevant violations are New Jersey's violations of plaintiffs, defendants in those cases, Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights. That's the source of plaintiffs' asserted harms, not ICE, which happens to be legitimately detaining them.
Aren't there some interests that come into play even at the outset? And for example, appointment of counsel, an initial appearance. As been mentioned earlier, evidence becoming stale. Witnesses whose memory becomes impaired. Say we talk about this in terms of the Fifth and Sixth Amendment. Why aren't it, with those interests in play, why should there be some parallel to things like providing a law library or providing the opportunity to consult with counsel within the facility?
Your Honor, because this is the access to courts doctrine is a very limited doctrine, and the Supreme Court has confined it narrowly to just these two categories. And extending it to this new category is not appropriate or necessary because there are other protections in this area. The problems, potential problems that you just mentioned, that Your Honor just mentioned, can be addressed by New Jersey criminal courts. If Fifth and Sixth Amendment problems arise, New Jersey courts can address them. And the other source of a remedy here is in immigration court. The 1252B9 issue came up at one point, and although it's true that we can find that argument to count too, the relevant point there is that plaintiffs can assert due process claims in immigration proceedings, and they can be reviewed by this court on PFR. And that's the remedy for any due process problem that arises in immigration proceedings. And the remedy for any Fifth or Sixth Amendment problem is in New Jersey criminal court, in this limited access to courts area.
Let's, classic access to courts, library. Would the government's position be that if the interest in accessing the library and doing the research was for purposes of defending against an ongoing state habeas proceeding or a state case, that it wouldn't be subject to a right of access because it's outside the bounds of the federal sovereign?
No, Your Honor, no. The access to courts doctrine does apply when the underlying case is a habeas case or a civil rights conditions of confinement claim. But
I'm positing that those are state law claims. They're proceeding in state court, not federal court. Would you confine the right of access to a library to only the federal charges against a detainee?
No, Your Honor, but this is not a law library case. It's one thing to ask a federal facility to make this law library available. This is a court appearance case. It's another thing to require ICE to drain its resources and take resources away from facilitating immigration hearings and meetings between immigration attorneys and their clients, rather than, you know, and provide those resources instead for state criminal proceedings or whatever other state proceedings. You know, my friend mentioned that ICE has in some cases done this for family court proceedings. If an access to courts right existed in this area, applied nationwide, it could create a huge drain on ICE's resources. If any ICE detainee could come in and say, I want to be able to litigate my claim in state court.
I understand it from the record, at other facilities, the federal government is providing this sort of access. Is that right?
At other facilities, Your Honor? You said, Your Honor?
Yes. Is that correct, that understanding of the record here?
I'm not aware that ICE is doing that in any particular case. That may be in the record. I'm not aware of that being in the record, Your Honor.
So, arbitrariness is, you know, another reason in some of these cases that if what's being restrained is you know, the use of law students rather than lawyers. So, talk to us a little bit about why. With the decision to give access to family court and immigration proceedings remotely, but not these criminal proceedings.
Your Honor, that may be because the scope of the drain is far greater in this area. Perhaps the number of family court proceedings to which ICE was being asked to facilitate access was much smaller, and perhaps ICE believed that advanced immigration proceedings in some way and that was beneficial. I'm not sure of the reasons, but ICE is entitled to make its own decisions in that area. As you mentioned, the detaining sovereign, the federal government in this case, is typically given deference in this area, and that's appropriate. Counsel said that facilitating New Jersey criminal proceedings is not displacing one sovereign, but that's just a product of this technology. The fact that now appearances can be done virtually rather than the prisoner or the detainee having to be turned over physically to the other sovereign's custody. And while that's true, it still requires ICE to use this technology to make its technology available for one type of prosecution rather than another, and it doesn't have unlimited amounts of technology and funds to spend on, buying new spaces for these hearings to occur and tablets for detainees to use for these purposes. It's a drain on ICE's resources, and ICE is entitled to set its priorities and use its resources as it thinks is appropriate.
Do we take account of the extent of its own control over things like the extent of the population in a given facility that makes rooms less available?
No, Your Honor. The reason that plaintiffs are in federal custody is because they haven't, because you know, immigration judges found them to be a flight risk or a danger to the community. That's why they're in federal custody, and they, you know, the fact that they're in federal, you know, in custody because they weren't able to get a bond at a bond hearing shouldn't provide a basis to, you know, to excuse or to say that ICE is responsible somehow for this lack of resources. My friend also mentioned Cobb. That case didn't involve two distinct sovereigns, or at least the opinion doesn't show any awareness by the court. As my friend mentioned, some class members may have been in federal custody. The court didn't say anything about that, as far as I'm aware. And the court also did not say that a custodial sovereign assumes the prosecutorial sovereign's Sixth Amendment duty. On Prater, there, the court said that the plaintiff needed to show that official interference caused the loss of a meritorious underlying claim, and the court remanded for that inquiry and cited Harbury. Those requirements are critical. The Harbury requirement, the plaintiff must identify an underlying claim. Appellees haven't done so. The court has no further questions. We would ask that the court reverse and remand with instructions to dismiss for lack of standing. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both for your very helpful argument in this important case. We appreciate all the time and effort that went into your preparation as well as amicus. We will take this case under advisement.